They say we're jumping forward, and let me just draw your attention back to verse 8, the first word. He says, finally. And, you know, it doesn't mean like that's, he's not wrapping up as far as like finally and then the book ends, because it goes on for a couple more chapters, right? And, of course, as a pastor, I'm tempted to say, you know, that's kind of like what we do oftentimes in sermons. We say in conclusion or finally, and then it seems to go on still for a while. But really what Peter is doing is he's bringing the thought that we kind of started last week back in chapter 2, verse 12 or 11. He's bringing that to a conclusion. So this is sort of, he's winding down that thought that began back there. And if I can sort of, because we didn't preach through all of these things, I got to point out a few things before we jump forward into this text. But so a little bit of review. But what he's been talking about is that, like the last week's sermon was called "Converting Your Critics." Just look back for a second, if you don't mind, to chapter 2, verse 12, where he says that you're to have your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. And the idea of that is that, you know, through your life and your witness of your redeemed life, and I said this last week, but I'll repeat it again, that we are studying Christian apologetics on Tuesday night in our Bible Institute. Apologetics meaning giving answer, giving proofs for what we believe. And I said last week that the greatest apologetic for Christianity is a redeemed life. When people can see the reality of Christ in you, that's what is probably more than anything else a better testimony or witness to the lost. And so he says in these verses, this is how you're to live, and you live this way because in living this way, you're going to be a witness, you're going to be a testimony, you're going to be an example. It's really the same principle what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, where he said, "So let your light shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." So he's talking, this is what he's been, this whole passage that we're kind of coming to the end of here today has been about living the life that we might call an evangelistic life. A life that is a witness for Christ and a powerful witness. So in that, he talks about it in a couple categories, if you will, in the sense that the relationships we have, and he points out basically three where we can put this kind of redeemed life on display. And first one was as a citizen. You remember how he said back at chapter 2, probably about, I don't know, was it verse 13 or verse 12, or I guess it would be verse 13 or so, where he starts to say that to be subject to the higher powers or the authorities, to the king and to governors and so forth, right? So he's basically saying as a citizen, you're to live in a spirit of submission, not to be a rebellious citizen, not to be stirring up strife and conflict and rebellion, but to live as a citizen in such a manner as to glorify the Lord. Right. So we saw that last week, and that's probably where we spent maybe the most time. But we talked about that. We are to be subject. And he says, you know, it's not that these kings or authorities are necessarily, not that they're saved, not that they're godly, but that's not the point. The point is, as believers, we are to show ourselves to be good citizens, obedient, you know, and so forth, lawful, law-abiding citizens. So that's the first aspect. Then he talks to you as servants, and I think that's down about maybe verse 18 or something in chapter 2. Where is it? Oops, turned the wrong page. Yeah, verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear. And we don't use that kind of terminology today, as far as you don't call yourself a servant, probably. But if you work for an employer, you're a servant. And this is the relationship he's talking about, is basically that employer-employee relationship. And there again, so in these categories, this is how you're to live in a way in such that you can be a witness and your testimony can bring others to Christ. In your neighborhood as a citizen, in your workplace as a servant. Then you go to chapter 3, verse 1, and this is where I'm skipping over this, and I hope that it's not a mistake that I'm doing that, but it's in the area of your home. Look at chapter 3, verse 1. He says, wives, likewise, right, is the word likewise, which means in the same manner. Just as you are to do in your citizenship, just as you are to do as an employee, so likewise in marriage. Now he brings it to the home. And he says, you know, he talks to the wife that if you have a husband that's disobedient to the word, or in other words, he's not a Christian, he hasn't obeyed the gospel, he is not saved, that you may without the word, and it's not without the word, but without a word. I mean, in other words, not by your... I was going to say nagging, that kind of a thing of constantly preaching at him. But again, it's by your life that you live before your husband, as we're applying it to wives. You could reverse the roles and a husband who may be saved have an unbelieving wife. The same principle would apply, that you would love your wife and be Christ-like and all these things. So, and he says here, you know, it's not with the outward appearance, not the plaiting of the hair and putting on jewelry and, you know, and all of these things. That's just external, you know, trappings. But it's the inward, the goodness of the inwardness of your heart that really is going to make a difference. So again, I skipped forward, and I really did debate about it a long time and prayed about it, because I feel as though I'm not covering all this ground, but I think we've gotten the principle. I think we got the point that our, and I said it last time, but let me say it one more time, that we do need to speak. We do need to preach the gospel. We're not discounting that aspect, because it's not just that they're going to see your life and everybody's going to get saved because you live so nicely. I mean, they need to hear. Faith cometh by what? Hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So they need to hear it, but before they really will hear it, they need to see it. Does that make sense? I mean, you know, and it's just simply true is that your walk talks louder than your talk. I mean, so you can say it, and if you're preaching it and if you're speaking it, but you're not living it, they're not going to listen to what you're saying. So you have to live it out in your life. Now that's the general idea all through this section. And then we come now to where we are in chapter 3, verse 8, where he says, finally. And he's wrapping this idea up. And he says, finally. And then he gives them some things. And I want to just point out what he says here in verse number 10. Because as I mentioned in the email last night, that I've titled the sermon, The Good Life, which may lead your mind in a direction that's not what's going to come out, but we'll see what it is. He says, for verse 10, for he that will love life and see good days. And that's an interesting phrase. I think all of us would put our hand up. Yeah, we want to love life and see good days, right? And that's sort of like what we would call the good life. If you want to love life, there's a lot of people that don't love their life, sadly. Sometimes there's Christians that don't love their life. But if you want to love life and see good days, I would assume you do, then he gives us this instruction. That's what we're going to look at today. And it's very similar. It's basically the same again, he's kind of drawing this whole thing to a conclusion. So we could kind of put it in this sense. He says, essentially, you're to live this way, this Christ-like life that we've been talking about. You're to live this way, first of all, because it's right. Second of all, because it's a witness and a testimony of those around you. Thirdly, because we're going to jump back to it a little bit, but the very end of chapter 2, because it's like Christ, and that's how we need to live. But then number 4, you need to live this way because it's the good life. And it will bring good life. I mean, it'll be a joy to your life to do it. So those are all the reasons why we should live this way, as we've been talking about. Now, I'll just say this, and I don't want to spend a long time because we got lots of material to cover, but you know, the world thinks the good life is in what? In sin, in materials, in you know, as I was thinking about that thought of the good life and so on, that's something that perhaps in the Kootenays here and in our society in Canada, the truth of the matter is people do have it pretty good when you comparatively. We have a lot in this, I'm just talking about in the world's realm. There's a lot of things here that people think that, you know, this is the good life, to live in Castlegar, to live here in Canada, to live, you know, have such beauty and a bounty and all these things. That's the good life. And yet, so many of them, if you really get to know them, they're not happy. There's a lot of people live right here, have everything you have, and they hate life. And, you know, and sometimes they're distracted and they think that this is the good life. But it's interesting that the example that comes to mind is, of course, Ecclesiastes. You read about Solomon, and Solomon had everything. I mean, just literally anything that men think that if I had it, boy, that would be the good life. I mean, he had it. He had power. He was the king of a very powerful country of Israel. He had enormous wealth, immense wealth. I mean, the Bible says that in the days of Solomon, like silver was like, they walked on it. I mean, it just didn't mean anything because they had so much, and they had gold, and it was just a very, very affluent kingdom Solomon had. And you read about it, it's kind of really interesting when you read about Solomon's kingdom. They were shipping in apes and peacocks and all kinds. I mean, he had zoos of animals. He had every sort of finery that you could have in that day. Solomon had it. He had 1,000 wives and concubines. He had a huge harem. And so every physical thing that men think could be the good life, Solomon had all of that. He had wisdom. I mean, he had, you know, an intellect. He had much education. He had so many things. And when you read Ecclesiastes, what does Solomon say? He literally says he hated life. And he said, all of this is vanity of vanities. And so, what does that mean? That just shows us that somebody who chased those things, had those things, acquired those things, and yet he said, that's not the good life. So, you who don't have those things, but maybe are inclined to wish that you did, just listen to Solomon. You don't need them. It's vanity anyway. It's empty. That's what vanity means. It's empty. So, what is the good life? It's very much the opposite of what the world would say. So, I want to put this in a couple categories, a couple headings to help us wrap our minds around it. But I'm going to say, first of all, that as he describes the good life here, it is, number one, a proper attitude. We know that attitude is everything a lot of times, right? I mean, the world understands that. But the good life doesn't begin with what you experience on the outside. But it's about really the attitude on the inside. And so he describes what our attitude should be. As I was thinking about, you know, just that thought of attitude is important. When I visit, sometimes I'll visit people that are sick or afflicted and so on. I'll come home and my wife will say, well, how are they doing? And, you know, many times the answer is not, it's really not so much physically. How are they doing? I mean, they might have a broken bone. They may have a cancerous things going on in their body and all of that. But if their spirit is up, their attitude is good, then I can say to her, you know, they're doing good. Because they are, right? You understand that, don't you? It's not so much, I mean, they may be having, and yet at the same time, you know, they could have something that's not that severe, but if their attitude and their spirit is down and so on, I'd say, yeah, they're not doing very well. They're struggling. Because it's about the attitude of the heart. And what is the attitude of the heart? There's another illustration I read. A chaplain was speaking to a soldier who was lying in a cot in the hospital, and he said, you've lost your arm in the great cause. This is obviously a wartime scenario. And the soldier replied, no. He said with a smile, I didn't lose it, I gave it. And that's a matter of perspective, isn't it? So attitude. What should be our attitude? Well, Peter describes it here in verse 7 with five different words, basically. He says, verse 8. He says, finally, be ye all of one mind. There's the first attitude, like-minded. It's the idea of a harmonious spirit. And that's an important attitude. It's the attitude or the spirit of the heart of unity, of harmoniousness, of getting along, right? To be of one mind. To put it in a negative sense, it's the absence of strife or conflict. And so part of the attitude he's going to describe here in five different words is that we should be like-minded. Now, that's true in churches, we understand. Churches and Christianities, and let's face it, if we're going to be living this evangelistic lifestyle, our life to be a witness, one of the most damaging witnesses in Christianity is when there's strife and fighting and, you know, and all of that. And so, you know, it's a bad thing. And many times it's misperceived. Sometimes, you know, like you've hear about in the past, like wars in Ireland or something, and they think it's the Catholics against the Protestants and this sort of thing. And that kind of a testimony is very harmful. Now we could point out all the flaws and what they're thinking about that. But the point is, we need to maintain a unity and a harmoniousness, to be like-minded. That's written all over the New Testament. He says many times, be like-minded, be of one mind, one accord, and so on. But these don't only apply to the brethren right here. It's really the attitude that if we have that kind of attitude, we're going to take it with us out there as well. And so it's almost in the same attitude where Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall have peace. That's the kind of spirit, that's the kind of attitude that we should have, is this attitude of harmoniousness, peacemaking, not bringing contention, not adding to the strife, but rather reconciling things and people. That should be our heart. That should be the attitude. And I understand, you know, Paul said, as much as possible, live peaceably with all men. And sometimes, you know, it's not always possible to end all strife. But it ought to be the heart and the attitude of a believer, is to have that desire to be a peacemaker. All right, we have to move along and we'll sum these up a little more. The next word is, he says, to be like-minded. Verse 8, having one mind. Then the word compassion. Compassion. And this word compassion is literally the Greek word. It means to have fellow feelings. That's kind of the definition. It's really kind of the idea of sympathy. The idea of having feelings, you know, like-minded feelings toward them, to be sympathetic. And that should be characteristic of believers as well, to be sympathetic. I wrote down, are Christians known only as sitting in condemnation of the world or with little sympathy? Or do we project a sympathetic heart? Do we not, I'm going to read a little bit because I'm trying to get through this point to the next one. We do not castigate and condemn people who are struggling with issues of life as fallen creatures. We come alongside it with sympathy and give them truth. So we're to have a harmonious attitude, a sympathetic attitude. And then I'm going to move a little fast, and then we'll kind of come back and sum these up. Also, he says, love as brethren. And that's an adjective. It means to be loving brethren, or to be brethren who are loving. And we know very well what Jesus said, that by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. So love has to be, you know, a paramount thing that is characteristic of every believer. And that love, again, it starts in with the brethren, it starts in the church, but that attitude carries on everywhere to love, to show love and concern and compassion and sympathy and the desire for unity amongst people. And then the word be pitiful. It's the idea of full of pity. And the word is basically, it means tender-hearted, to be of tender affections. The feeling of pity, the feeling of compassion, a tenderness toward others. Courteous, humble-minded is the next word. So that's the attitude that we're to have. Are you still with me? Now here's the thing. This is, you know, something I observed pretty early on in my Christian life. There is kind of a hard balance to strike. It is a little bit difficult, because on the one hand, we recognize, and we don't try to pretend that sinful behavior and sinful things aren't sinful, right? We have to see and call sin what it is, and all of that. So there's that aspect in which, you know, we are, as we learn throughout this book, we are strangers, we're pilgrims, we're different. And so when we're in the world, and the world is living all types of sinful lifestyles, and they relish in sin, and they live in sin, and we're trying to rid that sin out of our life. We're trying to, you know, separate from that, and we need to do that. We're trying to live holy and just and so forth. So how do you then maintain a harmonious, sympathetic, compassionate attitude? And it can be a difficult balance sometimes. What I've watched in churches, and this is what I observed early on, was that churches go either way. Churches will either capitulate, you know, in the sense that they'll compromise and they'll just accept sinful behaviors and not call them sinful. They'll just coddle people in lifestyles that are ungodly. And that's not just the big ones you're thinking about. I'm talking about in many, many areas of life. You know, the Bible says things about separating from not only fornicators and adulterers and so forth, but even covetous, and, you know. So there's some churches that ignore sin. They just let it go on. They tolerate it. They enable it. They sometimes they normalize it, and they just don't even call it sin anymore. Then you have on the other side, you have churches that preach hard against sin, and you know, and they and as we do want to preach hard against sin. We want to you know, call things what they are, because we see that sin is damaging, it's harmful, it's wicked, it's against God, and we need to live holy lives. But in that, many times, if we're not careful, it creates a Phariseeism. It creates a kind of like, well, we're holy and they're a bunch of evil sinners. You know, and that's not the mentality that Jesus had at all. Think about it. Jesus is and was absolutely pure and holy, untainted by sin whatsoever. And yet when you look at his attitude toward sinners was one of compassion and love and sympathy and tenderness. Right? So that's that balance that sometimes we who I put us on this side where we acknowledge what is wrong, we don't want to enable and condone and coddle sin. We want to, especially in the life of believers, our goal and our preaching and our desires, and when we preach hard against sin, it's because we want to say, look, these things are wrong and we can't live in them and we can't do them, and they're going to destroy our life, they're going to destroy our testimony, they're going to wreck your home. That's what sin does. That doesn't mean that if you're struggling with sin that we think, you know, that we're not sympathetic towards you. Because the fact is, all of us, but by the grace of God, we're all sinful at heart. So, I think in 20 years, most everybody in our church, you recognize that even when I've called sin what it is and preach hard against it, but then you come to me and you say, look, I have this going on and I'm struggling with this, you're not going to find condemnation from me. You're going to find compassion. You're going to find a desire to help and a sympathetic heart. And that's the attitude that God wants us to have. So it's not condoning sin. It's not compromising on sin. Because sin is that's what wrecks lives. It's not loving to say, oh, well, that's okay. You just, that's who you are and it's fine and nobody's going to say anything about it. That's not loving, to let them wallow in that sin. The loving thing is to say, look, you know, Christ can deliver you and you can have victory, and the Lord wants you to walk in a life that's a good life. It's not the life of that Solomon would say is vanity. And so the loving thing is to help them come out of that. The loving thing is to help them, to disciple them, to pray with them, to encourage them, to lift them up. Ye that are spiritual, restore such a one who is fallen in the spirit of meekness. So this is the idea Peter is saying here. This is the attitude that we're to have. And we need to have a proper attitude. The second thing, and I already know my clock is running down here, is a proper response. Look at verse 9. We can sum this up pretty quickly. He says, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but counterwise blessing, knowing that ye are there unto call, that ye should inherit a blessing. So what is he saying there real quickly? It's simply this: don't retaliate. Don't render evil for evil. That's like action. Or railing for railing, that's your speech. So you don't act out. If somebody's acted evil towards you, you don't act evil back to them. If somebody's spoken badly about you, you don't rail on them and spit out accusations or, you know, railing back upon them. Warren Wiersbe is a commentator I was reading. He said this. He said, you can live on one of three levels. You can render evil for good. That's the level of Satan. He said, or you could render good for good and evil for evil. That's the level of humanity. Or you can render good for evil. That's the level of divinity. And we're to be on God's level. God rendered good for evil. When they rendered him evil, he gave good back. Rather than railing, rather than accusing, rather than an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, he rendered kindness, blessing. And that's what he's saying here. We need to be like that. We're out of time almost, but I was going to take you back to chapter 2, verses, down there at the end, about verse, 21 on. And it just says that when Christ was railed upon, when he was, they treated the way he was treated. Here is a man, the Lord, who is he was the most innocent man ever in the world, but yet treated the worst. And what was his first reaction? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And all those things about not railing back, not returning evil for evil, that all sums up to one word. It's the word forgiveness. And the Bible tells us over and over again, we need to forgive others as Christ has forgiven us. So that's the response. You need to have a good attitude and then a good response. The response is not throw back at them, not, I don't get mad, I get even kind of an attitude. It's an attitude of forgiveness. And how do you do that? And it's almost like I read to you in Psalms 34, because Peter's telling them all this. And these are, and you got to remember the context of who he's writing to. He's writing to people who are suffering persecution. They're suffering all kinds of manner of evil against themselves by others. And he says to them, you be in submission, you be humble, you be sympathetic, you be forgiving. And after a while, I could hear him saying, come on, Peter, really? I mean, we got to do all of that? And he says, remember, and I think that's kind of why he's quoting from the Psalms. He's saying, yeah, remember, this is what God said all the way back in Psalm 34. He said, if you want to love life and see good days, this is how you're to behave. And it's the way Christ did. Let me show you in chapter 2, verse 23. Who, when, this is Jesus, when he was reviled, he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not. But here's the important little phrase. But committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. What does that mean? That means he didn't retaliate. He left it up to the Father. He committed it to him. And that's how we do it. We just, we just know that we can't retaliate. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. He'll repay. He'll take care of it. I don't have to take matters into my own hands. I don't have to strike back. I just give it to God. God will take care of it. He'll judge righteously. And he'll reward those that are faithful. All right, we have to close. So how do you live the good life? Doesn't sound like anything like the world would tell you. But have the right attitude. Have the right response. And then lastly, the right motivation. The right incentive. And it's there at verse number, I think it's 12. Here, look at verse 12. And I'll read 11 just to remind you of this. Let him eschew evil. That means shun it. Hate evil. Get away from it. Do good. Let him seek peace and ensue it. Or as it said in the Psalms, pursue it. But here's the motive. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. Now that phrase, the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous. Sometimes when we think about the fact that God is watching, sometimes we think of that in a negative sense. You know, watch what you're doing because God sees you. You know, God knows what you're doing. And that's true. That is true. I told my kids that, you know. I tell myself that. Remember, God, nobody else might see it, but God does. But in this verse, it's not a negative thing, it's a positive thing. The eyes of the Lord are over the righteous. Why? Because his ears are open to your prayers. And so in other words, he's watching. He sees when you are receiving evil, but you're not returning it, you're returning blessing. When you are humbling yourself and being sympathetic and harmonious and all of those things, God sees that. And God is, he's ready to answer your prayer. So when somebody has treated you bad and you give it to the Lord, you say, Lord, help me to be like Christ. I'll leave the judgment, I'll leave the justice up to you. And when you put yourself in that kind of position and people will trample on you. And people do take advantage of you. But God's watching. And God will hear your prayer. He'll supply your need. And he'll bring the blessing. And that's where the good life comes from. Because you have an attitude toward your fellow man that's not of strife and fighting and wars and in conflict. You have a life that you're living before the Lord and your conscience is clear. And you have the blessing of God coming down through the answer of prayer. That's the good life. You're not at odds with people. You're not at odds with God. You're right in both directions. And the blessing of God comes upon your life. So, finally, do these things. And then he says, I'll just read it and we'll close. Because the principle is, verse 13, who is he that will harm you if you follow that which is good? But stand and we'll have prayer.